versus United States. Ms. Rowan.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bridget Rowan. I'm an attorney with the Department of Justice, and I represent the United States, the appellant in this case. May it please the Court, this is a tax refund suit. The government is appealing the grant of summary judgment in the case.
But you know what's frustrating about this appeal? Both of you have completely untenable positions. Since it's obvious that these pesos are worth more than $11.1 million and less than $19.5 million.
Well, Your Honor, I think that was my...
right?
That was perhaps my initial...
$19.5 million worth of pesos that you can only use in Mexico. You know, that's a restriction. Mexican government may change their rules, take your license away to build your plant, so it's worth less. On the other hand, I certainly agree with you, it was worth more than the $11.1 million. It was a good deal for Kohler. But I don't see how you can, with a straight face and this feeble deposition by Edwards, say that it's worth $19.5 million.
Well, Your Honor, I guess that goes to the heart of the case, which we think is a question of the credibility and weight that should be accorded the testimony of our expert, Professor Edwards.
But don't worry about credibility and weight. You just look what he says. He says, I don't know. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. I didn't try to figure out what other sort of currency restrictions, you know, what kind of discount they require.
Your Honor, I think that's something of...
You didn't do any research. You didn't do any studies.
Oh, I think that's...
You didn't do any comparisons with other restricted currency deals.
Your Honor, I think that's an unfair characterization of Professor Edwards' report. I mean, Professor Edwards is a respected economist.
The question is all the concessions he make. I didn't do that. I didn't do that. I don't know.
Well, let's take something really specific. He did not calculate the cost of the restriction due to the complexities of the analysis. How do you run away from that? I mean, that's really the heart of it, it seems to me, and I agree with Judge Posner. That's a critical factor.
Your Honor, what I believe you're referring to is Professor Edwards' testimony on deposition, that
right.
He didn't do a net present value analysis. There were a number of kinds of analyses that he said could have been done, but they're very complex and very expensive, and at the end of the day...
Complex, very expensive. Anytime a business has to decide whether to obtain restricted foreign currency, it has to make a calculation of, you know, how much can I afford to pay for $19.5 million worth of pesos?
And, Your Honor, what Professor Edwards explained in the course of his analysis, which I submit is a thoughtful analysis, and, of course, it was submitted in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, so it doesn't reflect the entirety, I suppose, of what he would testify to at trial. But what Professor Edwards explained was this...
Was it an expert
report? Yes, Your Honor. That it was a fund of
$19
million...
Okay, expert report, right?
For purposes of summary judgment.
For purposes of the trial. You can't go beyond the expert.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but there would be nuances. Professor Edwards would be able to explain.
I'm not interested in nuances. The point is, these studies that he says he was too busy to do or they're too complicated for him, he can't, having, you know, renounced them on summary judgment, he can't pop up at trial and say, oh, by the way, you know, I've done these studies now and... No, that's too late.
No, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that he would then
say that there was... Summary judgment has nothing to do with it.
That he would conduct a net present value. His position was that those kinds of analyses were unnecessary, that on the face of it, this peso account was worth $19.5 million. It had to be used in Mexico. That's true. That was basically the restriction. But the taxpayer had made a commitment to spend $30 million in Mexico in any event before they even heard of this debt swap agreement.
You mean Kohler couldn't change its mind and say, I don't want to do this plant?
Then it wouldn't have entered into the debt swap arrangement,
no, it does,
Your Honor.
No.
I think.
Look, there are all sorts of uncertainties about this plant. Right? It might turn, the market for whatever they're going to make there might collapse, or, you know, labor cost change or safety requirements, anything could change that could cause them to abandon the project. Then they have, you know, $19.5 million worth of pesos that they have to spend elsewhere in Mexico. And maybe that's, you know, there's nothing else they want in Mexico. So
I think the evidence, at least on summary judgment, was sufficient to establish that the...
Say at least on summary judgment. You seem to think that summary judgment can be denied on the theory that the non-movement can generate some additional evidence for the trial. Not true. The test is, if there were a trial based on just the evidence presented on summary judgment, would the moving party be entitled to judgment? Because the opponent, in this case the United States, had no evidence.
Well, Your Honor, and I submit that I agree with you that would be the test. The moving party, in this case the taxpayer, has the burden of proof in this case. The only evidence they submitted as to the value of the peso account was the $11 million that it paid for the discounted debt on the secondary market with Bankers Trust. And you yourself, Your Honor, have said that that evidence on its face as to the value of what they actually got from Mexico is absurd on its face. Because the taxpayer has the burden of proof to show what the refund it is entitled to, if that's all the evidence it has, the taxpayer loses, because we have rebutted that evidence with, well, on the face of it, I think the evidence is rather absurd, because nobody would go into this kind of transaction. I mean, what, of course, Kohler could have taken its $11 million and taken it to the currency exchange, and it would have received $11 million in pesos. Instead, they went through this rather elaborate sort of transaction with Mexico so it could get $19.5 million. And its own executive, its own project specialist in charge of it, reported to the higher-up executives in the company that they had just realized a gain of $8.3 million. It was a wonderful deal for Kohler. And on
you know now a lot more than you knew then, the government does. It seems to me that this could be fairly easily calculated. For example, all the money had to go through Mexico. They actually paid out the money. So you had to submit the invoices or whatever. I don't know what it was. Suppose Mexico says, well, you got to use that labor union, even though they're cheaper ones. They had other restrictions of how that money had to be used. Those are conditions you didn't really know, neither party knew at the outset, but you know now. And you know if there's were these additional requirements that Mexico may have put on there, what those were worth. And they may have reduced fairly significantly the value of that exchange.
Of course, Your Honor, the taxpayer did engage in a kind of it engaged in analyses of those issues before it decided to enter into the debt swap.
No, we hope so. I don't know. It's a big spread, and one that they probably were willing to take some risk because it probably wouldn't descend to $11 million.
And I'd also like to point out, Your Honor, that
the plant built.
Pardon me?
Was the plant built?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. It was built, and all the money was spent within 3 years. But I would also like to point out, Your Honor, that to the extent the money was tied up, as it were, in a bank account and could not be spent immediately on things like land, although they immediately spent some money on land to purchase on which to build the factory, because they had chosen the site for the factory, the fund was accruing market rate interest. The experts testified to that, and the record shows they were getting the LIBOR value plus some other percentage. So it was like they had a bank account of $19.5 million that was accruing interest and was also protected against devaluation of the peso. And they could do whatever they wanted with that interest. So, you know, given the fact that they had made this corporate commitment, that they had analyzed they had done a very good job of analysis of the commitment to the plant, because they, in fact, did build it, and they spent all the money.
Do they have the burden of persuasion?
Yes, Your Honor. I think in a tax refund suit, I think that's what cases like Ruth and other cases that we have...
Would there be a different burden of persuasion if they hadn't paid and instead this was a tax court proceeding? Does that change burden of persuasion?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that question. I think I would say the taxpayer ultimately always bears the burden of persuasion. But that, in the tax court, it would be with respect to the deficiency notice and whether the commissioner's deficiency notice is solid.
Were you done?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Can you talk about this GM Trading Corp case and the Fifth Circuit's ruling there and why we shouldn't follow their ruling that no gain was realized by the investor in the debt equity swap transaction, which was nearly identical to Kohler's?
Sure. I'd be happy to address that, Your Honor. The district court, we think, correctly declined to follow GM Trading. The district court distinguished GM Trading on a factual matter, that in this case, the corporation had clearly made a commitment to invest in Mexico. GM Trading was decided by the Fifth Circuit on this theory that Section 118 of the Internal Revenue Code applied to the payment that was received from Mexico or the peso account, and that it should be bifurcated, and a portion of it should go to the service that Kohler was providing by helping Mexico retire some of its foreign debt at a discount, and the remainder should be a non-taxable contribution to capital. I guess we have several problems with the case. The case is very confusing, and if you read the beginning and the end of it, as I did before this argument, it doesn't make a lot of sense because on the one hand, the court is saying that there was a presumption of equivalence in value, but then it's saying there was a big difference and there was a difference in value between what they paid for the discounted debt and then what they got in pesos. So there are some logical inconsistencies in the opinion. It's not a very sound legal theory. And, of course, our position, the commissioner's position in that case was that that under 118 you shouldn't be bifurcating, that the predominant purpose, which was assisting in debt retirement, should be the one that controls. And there is factual, of course, and then the second point is that that's really a factual question also. You'd have to get into an inquiry as to what portion is for, if you bought into the GM theory, what portion goes to debt retirement and what goes to capital expenditure, and then you'd probably have open years. I mean, it kind of opens up a big can of worms. But there is evidence in the record. I mean, Professor Edwards did address that GM question, so there is evidence there, but there would have to be, if the court were to...
Your argument that you didn't need Professor Edwards, that they just, that if they had the burden of persuasion, they don't have any evidence?
Well, that was part of our argument, Your Honor. I mean, but that is not that. I mean, there were sort of two strings to the bow. One was that they came forward. Well, they didn't come forward really as a factual matter on summary judgment. They had a legal theory that the Davis case required a presumption of equivalence in value between the properties whenever the value of the property that was received in the exchange was somehow difficult to ascertain. And the district court correctly rejected that legal theory, but seems to have just ignored the factual evidence in the record. But so they weren't coming forward on a fact-based sort of case. So one of our arguments was, yes, the only thing they have in the record here is what they paid for the debt on the secondary market, the $11.1 million. They didn't put on any expert testimony. All they did was attack Professor Edwards and Professor, the other academic, the other economist who submitted a report. They didn't come forward affirmatively, other than the fact that you know, what's undisputed, they paid.
So if we were to grant you relief, would you be looking for just a straight reversal of the court's ruling or a remand? Because when we look back at the holes in Professor Edwards' calculation, I don't know how much we're left with, to be quite honest. And so, you know, I'm wondering, you know, is that what you're wanting, a straight-up reversal or a remand so this thing can be calculated? I mean, of course, you know, discovery was closed, and I'm still having problem with the fact that Edwards admitted that he didn't do what I think is the critical calculation.
Your Honor, we'd be certainly be delighted with an outright reversal on the grounds that the taxpayer bore the burden of here and it submitted no evidence. And
but
and
you
so
know,
it
it's really an unsatisfactory record, because what you're saying in effect is that the Commissioner of Internal Revenue can slap on, can say, well, you paid 11, you got something, paid $11.1 million, but we think you had a tremendous deal and you made $1 billion. And then somehow they can just sit there and say, that's what we say, $1 billion, and then the other side has to put in some mountain of evidence to try to persuade that they didn't make that much money. I mean, shouldn't the government have to have some burden of production to show the plausibility, realism of its estimate?
Well, I guess that goes to the remand aspect, Your Honor, and we would say that we did come forward with something to rebut what very little that they proffered in the way of support for their summary judgment.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Rowan. Mr. Carter?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Philip Carter. I'm an attorney with Miller & Chevalier representing the plaintiff appellee Kohler Company. I heard Ms. Rowan say today that the taxpayer introduced no evidence in this case. Actually, this case was presented to this court with the notion agreed to by the parties that the taxpayer did present evidence. It presented evidence of value, specifically what was paid for the peso credits.
It's an evidence. Clearly, what you got for your $11.5 million, that $19.5 million worth of pesos, was worth more than $11,100,000.
Well,
that is obvious.
Let me start by addressing that issue, because if that's true, then notwithstanding that there might have been an additional value, which I would dispute.
I would say notwithstanding. There obviously was an additional value.
I mean,
we know it looking back. You got the $19.5 million worth of pesos, and you used it to build your plant.
Well, this is one of the reasons why, to address this, all I need cite to is a statement in the appellant's brief on page 23 of their reply, where they say that the risks were compensated for by the investor getting more money than it could have received in a simple purchase of currency. Translation of that is that if you received unrestricted pesos and you pay $11 million, because there's no dispute in the record that they paid $11 million, the value of the debt, in exchange for the pesos, the restricted peso credits that they received. If those pesos had been unrestricted, the government's own acknowledgement is that those would have been worth $11 million. Now, the fact that they're restricted does not mean that they're worth more.
No, that's completely wrong. If they were unrestricted, that would just mean, you know, $11.1 million was the market price for this quantity of pesos, and you could get it from anyone. The fact that they're restricted means that only some people can derive value from having pesos. If you don't have anything, if you don't want to buy stuff in Mexico, you don't need pesos. But you were one of presumably relatively few firms that wanted to make a large investment in Mexico. For you, these pesos were very valuable. For other people, they weren't. That's why. See, if you were right about the unrestricted, then everybody would pay, you know, the 19.5, would be able to get 19.5 million worth of pesos. It's just that people want to invest in Mexico can get that.
Everyone would be able to get 19 million of unrestricted pesos if they paid $19 million. The only reason they were able to get $19 million of restricted pesos was because there was a risk associated with those restrictions.
But the risk for you was very small. It wasn't zero, but it was small because you had a commitment to invest in Mexico. And looking back, we can see that you did, in fact, invest in Mexico, and you had a big windfall.
That doesn't take into account nearly the potential effect that the risks could have had on the investment. It's true.
They weren't so big that they push it all the way down to $11.1 million.
It's true that when a party enters into a transaction such as this and it does a risk assessment, it hopes that it's getting a bargain, that it's getting...
It's not a hope.
Or it may have an expectation.
It's a solidly grounded expectation.
But that expectation may prove to be wrong.
Anything can prove to be wrong.
And that's exactly right, and that's one of the reasons why the risk...
But then no one would pay taxes, right? No, that wouldn't make any sense.
Not at all. If you flip the transaction on its side, if each party... party could subjectively assign a value to what they think their transaction is worth, you'd have one side of the transaction arguing that they sold the property worth more for less, a loss. The other side saying that they received property that was worth less.
You're assuming that every transaction is a zero-sum game. Both sides can profit. The Bankers Trust or whoever sold you the pesos, they were happy to unload them for the $11.1 million. That's the market price. They're happy. That doesn't mean that you didn't make even more money out of the deal. That's typical, right?
That assumes that there was an appreciation of the property from the time it was acquired to the time it was exchanged. Otherwise, we have to...
You were in a unique position. These pesos were worth more to you than to the other, than to the rest of the market, and therefore... You know, I don't think they were worth $19.5 million, but they were worth more than $11.1. That's what's so unsatisfactory about the case. The real number is in between.
The problem I have with Your Honor's statement is that it assumes the market is a universe larger than what it was. The market is those parties that were interested in purchasing these pesos and investing
precisely
in Mexico.
Precisely the point.
Well, that market...
Precisely the point. That's a limited market.
And that market, with full knowledge of how much they would be receiving in the pesos at the time they entered into the transaction, all parties to that transaction, the bank knew it was trying to get the best price.
Bankers Trust didn't want to invest in Mexico. It didn't want to have pesos. It wanted to get rid of its pesos. For you, pesos were more valuable because you wanted to build this plant. That's why you were willing to, happy to pay the $11.1 million because it was worth much more to you.
The record reflects that the taxpayer sought to engage in a transaction where it could profit from that transaction, but it also recognized it could incur a loss. We simply don't know at that point.
And how could it incur a loss?
Well, there are many reasons why it could incur a loss. For one thing, the market for vitreous porcelain could have changed. The Mexican, as one of the panelists pointed out, the Mexican labor force could have required the use of labor that was not as efficient and less costly as opposed to an alternative. They were required to use Mexican vendors when perhaps a less costly, cheaper alternative would have been available. They were not able to sell the stock that they received in the exchange. If, for one reason or another, whether it had to do with the country or whether it had to do with the company's own individual decisions, it had wanted to pull out, it wouldn't have been able to do so, at least not without forfeiting whatever the remaining unused pesos were. And as we point out, those pesos were sitting in an account for a period of 3 years.
They were earning interest.
They were earning interest, but the interest, again, is to compensate for the risk. So the fact of the matter that the risks didn't materialize...
Wait a second. Are you saying that people don't have to pay taxes on interest because interest has a risk component?
The interest is not a part of this case.
Look what you're saying, though. You're saying interest isn't a real game because it's compensation for risk. And that's right? That's what you're saying.
No,
that's not what you just said.
The interest is taxable.
You just said interest wasn't any benefit to wasn't income.
I didn't say that.
Just offsetting the risk.
You're right about the second part. I did say that it does to some extent offset the risks. As far as interest being taxable or not, that's an entirely different question. Interest is income. It's taxable. That has nothing to do with this transaction.
Of course, it has a lot to do with it because the fact that you were earning interest during these 3 years means that the money wasn't frozen and you were earning money. That was another reason. That reduced the risk of some disaster to the plant. You would have had the interest.
But at the end of the day, all these questions that are raised have to do with the subjective intent of the parties, and the tax law does not provide for a system of valuation that's dependent upon subjective intent. It provides a system of valuation that's based upon hypothetical buyers and sellers.
Subjective intent.
Subjective intent of one party that they received a bargain, or subjective intent of another party that they overpaid. And let's just look at the overpayment.
Subjectivity to it. The question is, when your client decided to pay for these pesos, 11.1 million, it had some expectation as to what it would use them for, and it realized there was a risk. And I mean, let's look at it this way. Why does the record not contain evidence about comparable restricted currency transactions? Are there, for example, standard discounts when Kohler or someone else is buying foreign currency to invest in Brazil or Afghanistan or anywhere where there's foreign currency? Is there some kind of calculation they make? They say, well, we only, you know, this could be frozen, so on, could be devaluation, so we're valuing, you know, X million cruzeiros or something at this much below the exchange rate.
That's precisely the point. There is no market for these restricted pesos. There's no evidence in the record, and in fact, there is no market to resell these pesos. And in fact, the restrictions themselves.
I'm asking you about other markets. You can't tell me that Kohler goes into Mexico and closes its eyes and buys a bunch of pesos without any sense of what $19.5 million worth of pesos is worth to it.
These transactions are
extremely common.
It goes into the transaction believing that if everything goes according to the way it expects or hopes it will, then yes, it will have benefited from the transaction. But
it
doesn't.
That's how business operates.
Well,
hopes. They make calculations.
They do a risk calculation. Yeah, I call it hope. It's a risk calculation. The risks may manifest themselves.
Where is the risk calculation?
The risk calculation is that some of the restrictions.
Where is the risk calculation? Isn't there a piece of paper in which they made some computations?
There are papers in the record that reference Kohler's concerns about the transaction.
No, I'm talking about referencing their concern. Is there in the record a report, an internal report of some sort, which discusses what Kohler expects to gain from this transaction?
There are papers in the record that reflect one party's opinion that they could gain from this transaction, and there are papers in the report that conflict with that and say the risks
question.
May.
You have not answered my question. Is there a report, a risk calculation with numbers, which says, you know, we have this opportunity to buy pesos, and we can turn them over to the Mexican government, turn over money and get $19.5 million worth of pesos. And this is worth, you know, X, and when added to our other costs of building this plant, the plant will yield the following profit. Is there something, you know, something quantitative?
There is no report in the record. There are simply statements pro and con, both saying that if the risks pan out, they will have a benefit, and if the risks don't pan out, they will incur a loss.
So wouldn't it be the right way to determine a case like this to have to send it back and have the parties engage, you know, real experts familiar with these currency transactions who will say, yeah, you have to take off 10% for this risk and 10% for that risk, and 3 years is a long time to be tied up in pesos. And then on the other hand, there's the various guarantees and the interest rate, and this is what we think it's worth.
This is the reason why cases that have addressed this issue have said a far better way to determine value is to look at what was paid in the transaction.
That we know is wrong.
Well, there are many circuits that have...
Many circuits have not held that. Of course, there are cases like Davis where, you know, you just give up. You can't figure out what this, you know, marital surrender of marital rights was, but here we're dealing with strictly commercial activity. It should be possible to quantify
the Fifth Circuit
transaction.
Well, first of all, the experts attempted to do that, both the government's expert and the taxpayer's expert. The government's expert concluded that it couldn't do the valuation. It had years to attempt to do so. And in fact, the reason why the initial summary judgment was denied was because the government proffered that it would be able to analyze.
You have the burden of proof.
Correct. And ultimately, it's undisputed that the evidence in this record is that the company paid $11 million for the restricted credits. Now, taking everything that's been said, that is the only evidence in the record. The only alternative evidence that the government offered has been repudiated, obviously, in the court's decision, by other circuits, by the expert himself, and by the authorities relied upon.
Are you saying that if all you put into the record was that you paid $11.1 million for these pesos, and therefore there's no gain, that would satisfy your burden of persuasion?
Absolutely, Your Honor. As the district court noted, it may be the best evidence, it may be the evidence of last resort, but there's no dispute that it's evidence. And in fact, the government simply put this case before the court and said, yes, it is evidence, but we have evidence too. And we believe our evidence makes this case unsusceptible to summary judgment.
You're relying on this GM trading case, this Fifth Circuit case, but there's been no finding that Kohler's pesos are non-taxable contributions.
Well,
that hasn't been found here.
I wouldn't say that we're relying on GM trading. I do agree with Ms. Rowan that GM trading is somewhat of a skewed opinion in that it goes through this analysis of whether something in excess payment, as Judge Posner posits, it must be attributed to something. And the question is, what can it be attributed to? And the court in the Fifth Circuit simply said, well, we don't know. There's no evidence in the record what it could be attributed to. So in any event, we're going to rely on the only reasonable and logical evidence, which is that the best evidence is what was paid for the property whose value is being sought. Now, in this particular case, we're in the exact same situation. Whether you go through the Section 118 analysis or not, we submit we don't even get to that threshold. But even assuming that you do, the government's own expert, and this is in appendix or in the page 388 of the appendix, notes that there is no way for him to determine what portion of this so-called surplus would be attributable to debt extinguishment. It's no different than if a buyer comes in and decides to buy a house, and if they determine to finance that house either by using mortgage money or they're paying cash. There may be a cost associated with using the mortgage money, just as in this case there may have been a cost in converting to foreign currency to extinguish the debt. But the value of the house, just as the value of the peso credits in this case, is the same. In each instance, the value is the same. What a party subjectively determines the cost to them is completely antithetical to the tax law.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carter.
Thank you.
Ms. Rowan, do you have any time left? Well, you can have a minute if you have anything further.
Your Honor, I don't think there's anything I would add to my opening remarks unless the court has any questions.
Okay, fine. Well, thank you very much to both counsel.